I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order, and we have a quorum. And let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:37 p.m. on Thursday, April 5th, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, just a reminder, if folks could mute their cell phones. Today in committee, we will have the confirmation hearing of, I believe it's Vernay Berner for the Mental Health Trust Authority Board, and the second hearing on two bills, which is HB 240, Pharmacy Benefit Managers, and HB 219, which is criminal history checks on certain state employees and contractors. And it is my intent, if it is the will of the committee, to move these two bills today from House Finance. We also have with us Representative Kawasaki. And so, let's see here. With that, we will begin today with the confirmation hearing for Mr. Berner. And so, Mr. Berner, if you could put yourself on the record and tell the committee about yourself and why you'd like to serve on the Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees.
Hi there. This is Vernay Berner. My name is a little bit confusing. It does look like Vern. I was actually named by the Navy, and it follows French principles, but I've yet to meet a French person that's heard it. So my name again for the record is Vernay Berner, and I do have a prepared statement for you, if you like.
Yes, please proceed.
Thank you so much. Thank you to the co-chairs and members of the committee for this opportunity to share with you my experience and interest in serving as a trustee for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. I am very humbled and honored to be before you today. Again, my name is Vernay Berner. My Inupiaq name is Kaanak, after my grandmother. I'm an enrolled tribal member of the Sovereign Native Village of Kayana. In my other hearings, I started by sharing my earliest memory. I remember at what must have been about 4 years old, or at least right around there, I remember driving and being very proud of myself, snow go to the Army at the Head Start in Kayana. Kayana is my hometown where my grandmother and a dean or namesake served as one of the first generation community health aides. She was my first exposure to tribal health, and back then, patients often came to our home for care. We did not have a toilet, and I remember having to scamper in the middle of winter to the outhouse with all the scary stories of Inukuns and Nataks that my aunts and uncles used to tease me with. By the way, it's amazing to me that there are still many homes in Kayana that do not have water and sewer hookups. By the time I graduated, our tribal leaders, working with our elders, created the Inupiaq Ilkhosait, Inupiaq values, with the premise that every Inupiaq person is responsible to all other Inupiaq for the survival of our cultural spirit and the values and traditions through which it survives. Through our extended family, we retain, teach, and live our Inupiaq way of life. With guidance and support from our elders, we teach our children our Inupiaq Ilkhosait values. These were my formative experiences, and this is the briefest way I can think of introducing you to who I am and the foundational experiences I bring to the table. My specific interest in the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority comes from the tribes and tribal leaders. I'm the president and CEO for the Alaska Native Health Board. ANHB is a statewide voice on Alaska Native health issues. ANHB is in its 50th year as an advocacy organization for the health needs and concerns of all Alaska Native people, and its mission is to promote the spiritual, physical, mental, social, and cultural well-being and pride of Alaska Native people. Since returning to Alaska, and prior to that, our leadership has stated that the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees needs representation from those familiar with the Alaska tribal health system, particularly considering the overrepresentation of our people as the trust beneficiaries. The Alaska tribal health system is a true system of care with voluntary participation of sovereign tribes and tribal health organizations through a single negotiated compact with the federal government. The Alaska Tribal Health System provides health services for Alaskan Natives and American Indians in over 200 facilities and locations all across the state. The ATHS provides health care in every community and is a critical component of the Alaska Public Health System. I come before you today with the encouragement and blessing of the Alaska Native Health Board. With regards to my experience, I have worked for over 20 years in tribal health, health promotion and disease prevention, administration and budgeting, and have administration and budgeting experience. I serve tribes in the establishment and formation of tribal epidemiology centers and have over 13 years of experience serving on a tribal institutional review board, working on human protection issues with particular attention to the vulnerable populations, such as those who comprise the beneficiaries of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. I am also a Native American Research Centers on Health Fellow and hold a master's degree in public health and an undergraduate degree in business administration. My passion is addressing health disparities in Indigenous and minority populations through health research, policy development, education, and outreach. I am a firm believer in community-based approaches to best tap the existing strengths and resources these resilient populations have in order to address health disparities. I have observed that culturally intelligent approaches are needed to build upon evidence-based approaches in interventions, outreach, and treatment. I have the honor of being entrusted by tribes to represent them on issues from state and national levels, such as the Restructuring Initiative Work Group of the Indian Health Service, the National Indian Health Service Budget Formulation Work Group, as well as serving on translational research into practice advisory groups. With regards to Alaska's diversity and immigrant populations, I bring special experience. I consider myself to have three citizenships. I'm a citizen of my native village of Kayana, I'm a citizen of the United States, and I'm a naturalized citizen of Germany. Alaska has grown in so many ways in our lifetimes. Even in our small village of Kayana, we have naturalized citizens from around the world. I know that what it is like to go through that process and to seek health care and mental health services in a foreign country with limited command of the language. Naturalized families experience unique health issues and concerns of which I not only have learned about academically, but have personally experienced. My personal interest in serving is similar to that of all the other trustees. I have a very personal drive for wishing to serve, and I hope to honor my late sister. She lost her battle with alcohol 3 days prior to her 29th birthday. She was trying to quit and had no drugs in her system. The coroner's report listed her cause of death as natural due to complications of chronic ethanolism. And I pose that there is nothing natural about the death of a 29-year-old. I want to thank you for your time and consideration and welcome your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Berner. And let's see here. And Ms. Berner, if you could just submit your written statements to housefinance@akleg.gov. Again, housefinance@akleg.gov, just so we can put that on the record. And so with that, I just also want to note that we're joined at the start by Representative Grin. And does the committee have any questions? I don't see any questions, so you must have knocked it out of the park. thank you very much. So with that, I would like to recommend that Ms. Vernay Berner's name be forwarded to a joint session of the legislature for consideration. And I just would also like to remind folks that signing this conference report does not reflect intent by any member to vote for or against Ms. Berner's during any further sessions for the purpose of confirmation. So with that, let's take a brief at ease just to sign the report. And Ms. Berner, thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you, and I will send that.
Thank you. Finance is back on record. Our first piece of legislation today is HB 240 by Representative Guttenberg. Committee last heard this bill on Tuesday, April 3rd. Committee does have one amendment before them. Representative Guttenberg, Mr. Witten, I believe your aide, if you could come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and if there's anything else that you'd like to add before we move to the amendment process, you're welcome to. Otherwise, we will move to the amendment. So, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative David Guttenberg. The one thing that did change from when you had the previous version, when you adopted the previous version, is the fiscal note was zeroed out because of a change from shall to may. And that is your only significant change. We adopted a CS in the last meeting. The zero fiscal note from Department of Admin reflects the change that was adopted in the CS.
Great, thank you. Are there any questions on the amendments? Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chair, I kind of had two versions. Can you tell me what the number is? Is that D.3 or D.4?
The amendments.
I don't have three.
take a brief at ease. Okay, House Finance is back on record. So it looked like we had two amendment number ones. There was a D3 and a D4, and so D4 is the amendment we will be addressing. So with that, I will entertain a motion. Representative Guerra.
Chair, I move amendment number one, D.4.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, amendment D.4 has been adopted. And so with that, do we have any further questions on the bill itself? Looks like there are no questions. So with that, I would ask Vice Chair Guerra if you could walk the committee through the fiscal notes for HB 240.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just catching up. Mr. Chair, so to make sure it's the D version, it is the D version. Mr. Chair, we have what I believe is one fiscal note, but let me just triple check so everybody else is understanding. 2-0 fiscal notes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have 2-0 fiscal notes on the new version of House Bill 240. The first zero fiscal note is from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Appropriation Insurance Operations, Allocation Insurance Operations, OMB component number 354. That is a zero fiscal note, so it's free. And the second zero fiscal note is from the Department of Administration. The appropriation is Centralized Administrative Services, Health Plans Administration. That's OMB component 2152, and the Department of Administration has also, in that fiscal note, provided a zero fiscal note.
The committee have any questions on the two fiscal notes? Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I have a question on the one that is component number 2152. on page number 2, where it says the actual, and it's in the second paragraph, the actuarial analysis assumed that with this mandate, plan costs for generic drugs filled by independent pharmacies in Alaska would increase by 20%, and the assumed impact on chain pharmacy pricing would be 10%. Where does that come from? I mean, how do we know it's going to be 20% and 10%?
And
I'm assuming it was
Department of Administration.
Retirement Benefits wrote this one.
Who would be most prepared to answer that? If you could maybe just go ahead and come up and put yourself on the record.
Thank you. My name is Michelle Michaud. I'm the Chief Health Official for the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
And for the record, my name is Emily Ricci, Chief Health Policy Administrator in the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
And through the chair, the assumptions that were listed were in relation to the original fiscal note, the one that has now been resolved. It was numbers that were provided by our actuaries, and basically it boils down to that they thought that the language that required that an appeal shall be granted would not only increase the number of appeals, but would likely increase the MAC reimbursement rate for certain drugs. And as a result of that, and based on their analysis of utilization trends, that would increase those the independents by 20% and the chain pharmacies by 10%.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
So since this is a new fiscal note, why wasn't that removed? Because it seems to me that it's now in effect. That it just seems to me when it got zeroed, then that portion should have been taken out, since now we're not going to say there's going to be a 20% increase and a 10% increase.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci with the Department Division of Retirement and Benefits. That was an attempt in the fiscal note to explain why there had been a change from the previous fiscal note to this fiscal note. So the reference is it should be the prior actuarial analysis assumed versus the actuarial analysis assumed. But my understanding is there's a letter from our actuaries, from Siegel, that will accompany the fiscal note, the updated version that explains kind of their rationale as to why the change in language results in a zero fiscal note or an indeterminate fiscal note.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions on the fiscal notes? Seeing none, thank you for the information. Well, if there are no further questions on the fiscal notes, are there any questions on the bill itself? I don't see any. So with that, I would entertain a motion. Co-Chair Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 240, version 30, LS0868D from House Finance Committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Any objections? Seeing no objections, HB 240 version 30-LS0868/D as amended is reported out from House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal notes. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease and the report. Okay. House Finance back on record at 1:56 p.m. Our next piece of legislation is HB 219, which is criminal history checks on certain state employees and contractors by House rules by request of the governor. Committee last heard this bill on March 28th, 2018. Committee does have one amendment before them. And at this time, I'd like to have Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue, if you could come to the table and put yourself on the record, and just wanted to give you an opportunity if there's anything you'd like to say before we move to the amendment process.
Yes, for the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Tax Division, Department of Revenue. And just a little bit more background on this this bill that I may have skipped over in the last hearing. Publication 1075 is a publication that the IRS puts out that lists all the requirements that the states must follow in order to receive federal tax information. And the requirement to do the background checks and have fingerprinting be part of that background check is in that publication, and that's really the impetus of this bill. And the Department of Revenue, there's two divisions that receive that data. The Tax Division, we'd like to continue to receive that data to I did speak about those piggyback audits that we do, and as well as verify information that we receive from taxpayers. And then at Child Support, they receive very limited information. It's a federal offset program that they are able to capture money that would be refunded to taxpayers and to pay their child support instead. And I did misspeak in the last hearing. I noted that Department of Labor received data to verify wage information. That's actually not correct. They also do the federal offset program, so they're just there to recapture unemployment insurance that was paid out in error. So they also recapture through that federal offset program.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Mr. Spanos before we move to the amendments? And I don't see any, so thank you for the additional information. So at this time, we will go over to the amendment. Representative Wilson?
I move amendment number one.
Check.
And we have an objection. Representative Wilson, if you could explain the amendments.
Thank you. I'll just read amendment number one. Says it the best. Employees shall pay to the state the fee established by AS 1262-160 for the National Criminal History Record Check. If the employee does not pay the fee within 30 days after the criminal history record check or the date of hire, whichever occurs later, the fee must automatically be deducted from the employee's next paycheck. One more at a time, where we don't have a lot of money, we don't know exactly how many this may or what other departments may have to do. But I also wanted to make sure that they got the job and that they were getting paid before the fee would have to be collected.
Great, thank you. Are there any questions on the amendment, Representative Wilson? Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do just have a question. I guess I'm not 100% clear. So if an employee that works in the Department of Revenue right now, what you're saying is that they would have to pay the fee. Is that what you're aiming at?
Representative Wilson?
To Chair, Representative Kawasaki, not whoever this would affect. We found out that Department of Corrections,
right,
it was free. Others, you know, had different determinations, but this is ongoing. We don't know when the federal law will change and include more employees than it does now. But yes, I think this, as part of your employment, a lot of times you have to have a drug test, you have to have others, and the person is responsible for doing it. This would be part of the job. So I would think that versus the state paying more fees, that it would go to the person who has to have it.
And follow up.
So
there's a couple places. So if you work in the healthcare setting, you have fingerprints, and I've worked for two different healthcare organizations in which I had to get fingerprinted. I could serve as an employee, but I had to have fingerprints submitted within the first 30 days. I can't remember what the rule was. I never thought that I had to cover those for the cost of those fingerprints for my employment. The employer typically covers them, and I don't know if there's somebody that might be able to speak to that, that the employer typically covers that, not the employee who's getting their fingerprints done as a result of some change in federal law. I don't know who the best to answer that. And then I think a second question just put on the record is if this impacts any current labor contracts or how it would impact a labor contract.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
I can't tell you what every business in the state does, but I use an example. I had to have a TB test done before I did my first teaching job. It was part of the requirements to be able to work. I paid the cost of it because it, going into it, I knew that was going to be required, and it was my cost. So each employer I imagine some pay for them and some don't. Just like we learned that corrections was free, and obviously the Department of Revenue should go talk to Department of Corrections. Maybe they could get theirs free too because they do their own. So there might actually be a way of going around, not necessarily have to go through public safety. So because I found that interesting that some departments don't have to pay. So if they have it already set up, maybe something like that could also be arranged. But just to go and keep paying for things, we're just not in that kind of setting any longer.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
you know, I feel like what I've heard is correct from Representative Wilson. You know, there's a lot of different industries require that you get fingerprinted and background checked. Many of them, they have to pay for them themselves. To get a TAMS card to work in the liquor industry, even if you're a cocktail waitress and not a bartender even, you have to get fingerprinted. You have to go through the TAMS class. Majority of those people have to pay for that themselves because that's part of, if you want to work in that industry, that's what you have to do. And I would think that the cost to the state here is what we're looking at, and I support the amendment.
Thank you. And just so folks know, we do have available online Department of Administration with personnel, Division Director Kate Sheehan, also Division of Child Support Services, and the Chief of Criminal Records and Identification at Department of Public Safety. So just want to let folks know they're available for questions. Representative Kawasaki? Oh, Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I was just going to give an example. 15 years ago, so I don't know if they still do this, but when I was a substitute teacher in the Anchorage School District, before I was able to do that, I actually had to pay for my own fingerprinting. And they may have changed that since then, but it sounds like they may still. So that is a kind of a real-life example of another entity that does require you to pay for it before you can then move forward with the job in government. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki, and then Seaton.
Thank you, and I think I'll direct my question to the person from Division of Personnel. The question had to do with if there's a current collective bargaining agreement in place that, because we're not talking about employee pre-employment, we're talking about an employee that's currently, I thought you were online, and so we're talking about an employee who's currently employed by the state, and so we're kind of forcing them to do this. And I mean, I don't know what a fee for a background check actually costs, or if it's de minimis or small. But is that something that should have been built into a contract in the future that you'll pay fees for something like that? I mean, this is sort of a circumstantial type of piece of legislation.
And if you could just put yourself on the record.
Sure. For the record, my name is Kate Sheehan. I'm director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes, that is something that would need to be bargained with the unions.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions for Ms. Sheehan? Representative Seaton?
Thank you. And I'm trying to figure out not only the contract, but if it is an employee that is currently has health coverage through the state, is there any possibility that this is covered through the health insurance, the active employee health insurance, and if that, I'm trying to figure out whether the wording here, the employee shall pay to the state the fee, and I'm not sure what that fee is because we heard that it's about averages $47, I think, for fingerprints, but this says the national criminal history record check, and I don't know if that includes more expenses. Does that include the time? If you were reading that, would you be including the time it takes to conduct the criminal record check as well as the direct fingerprint fee?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I believe it includes more than just the fingerprinting, but I do not know that for a fact.
Okay. I guess maybe I should ask the sponsor what the intention here is. Is that the time and the administrative time that goes into the National Criminal History Record Check on line 4, or is it... because I don't see it for the fingerprinting fee.
Representative Wilson?
Mr. Chairman, so this is coming right out of the bill, the same type of fee. So on lines 10 through 12, it says the agency or procurement officer shall submit the current or prospective employees or contractors' fingerprints to the department with the fee established by AS 1262-160. So that fee that currently in here that's going to be charged is the same fee. We're just having the employee, so it's matching right up to the actual legislation.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I'm just having the problem that this is on line 19, I believe, on page, oh, three. I was on page two.
That's just where, Mr. Chairman, that's just where it's going to be inserted, but it's referring back to AS 1262-160, which is listed in section one on page one. And it's also my understanding that there's not a charge to take the fingerprints themselves. You go in, they do the fingerprinting, the fee is then to do the background check, and they have it turned back to them. Child care providers have to do it. A lot of schools have to do it. This is not, I mean, this may be new to the department of having to be in there, but fingerprinting is not something new. And again, you know, there's a possibility that, you know, and I don't know if anybody can answer the question, but as the Department of Corrections has a way of being able to do it, why could they not possibly do it for other state workers and make it so there is no fee whatsoever? That seems like the better of all of it, but I am not part of the Department of Corrections.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just trying to figure out, because the amendment says for a national criminal history record check, which is what is on lines 18 and 19, and we're talking about fingerprints, which is earlier in Section B, but I'm trying to figure out exactly, is that what this means? Is it it's only the fingerprint charge, not the charge for that is incurred by the agency for a national criminal history record check?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it's my understanding, again, back on page one, that the reason it says, and the next line says, department shall submit the fingerprints to the Federal Bureau of Investigation to obtain a national criminal history record. So all that's in 1262-160, this, my understanding, would be the entire fee of the $42, the approximate $47 that was in the fiscal note.
Representative Seaton.
Right.
And appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Ms. Sheehan. I guess that's Sheehan?
Yes.
Thank you. In relationship to the contracts that are in place currently, would those contracts have to lapse and be renegotiated and to include this or not include this to take offense? The people that are there right now under a current contract, this would not apply to them, or would it?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, it would apply to them. Our collective bargaining agreements contain a clause that says if there's something that does not comply with state or federal law, that the parties will meet and negotiate. So if this became law, we would need to meet with the unions and negotiate it prior to the contracts lapsing.
Okay, I'm sorry. Could you repeat that last part? You would have to meet with them to insert this, or is it automatic?
Through the chair, Representing Guttenberg, we would need to meet and negotiate. It would not be automatic.
Okay. So, and maybe I'm not sure who this is to, whether it's to the department or Ms. Sheehan, but it talks about two things. It talks about fingerprints, and it talks about the national criminal history check. There's a cost for getting your fingerprints done, and then there's a cost for the history check. Is there time loss involved in getting the fingerprints done if you have to leave the job and go to another place, or are they going to bring somebody in to do it on the job so it can be done wholesale, for lack of a better term? And then the fingerprints would be submitted by the department for the background check, or is there a lost time involved in this if they have to leave work? Do you know the processes or what that is?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I don't know what the process would be. I don't know if it's an option to bring someone in or if it's only done in certain places. I know Department of Corrections, for instance, does it themselves. The employee on their first day of work goes because Department of Corrections has the capability to do fingerprinting. I don't know if there's an operation that comes in or if an employee would need to leave work and whether or not they could do it on work time or if it would be on their free time.
And if it was, if they were required to do it outside of work time, would that also would have to be negotiated
with the bargaining group?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, not necessarily. There are things that we're required to do on our free time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kawasaki and then Guerra.
I think most of my question was just answered. I guess my thing is that for continued employment, that there is currently a clause within the collective bargaining agreement that says that there's changes to federal law that you come back to the table at some point in time. So this legislation would basically force that. If we added this amendment, it would basically say, and you'll also, as an employee who works in tax division, that now must be fingerprinted because of federal law, that'll have to come out of your paycheck. Is that what will be negotiated?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes, I think there'd be several things. There would be the requirement that the employee pays for the fingerprinting for the background check. I don't know if we could deduct it from the pay under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. You are entitled, some employees are paid for each hour, minute they work, so that would have to be discussed at the table. And then, of course, if a current employee were to not pass the background check, we would have to do a type of effects bargaining.
I guess that's my big concern is for folks who are currently employed. This wasn't a precondition. They weren't prospective employees like all the other examples we've had today. That I have a little trouble that this will now apply to a person who's a current employee. I think in future employment, I think that makes sense. You could put that in future contracts just for current employees that have got problems.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to make sure I understand this correctly because actually I don't have a great grasp of exactly which employees are going to have to go through this criminal history check. But this is now a condition of an employment. It's done to comply with federal law. An employee who works for the state, we can do it one of two ways. The state, knowing this is a condition of employment, can pay for it, or this amendment would say the employee who's being required to do this by their employer has to pay for it. In my view, employees went through 2 years of wage freezes, this is not sort of a luxury thing that an employee is doing. It's something an employee is being required to do by their employer to comply with federal law. So unless I have any of that, is my understanding correct so far? I forget about my policy argument, but is my understanding correct? This is a condition of employment now?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes, it would be.
Yeah, then I don't support this amendment. I don't support charging the fee to prospective employees who are applying for a job. I don't support it. It's something somebody has to do as a condition of employment.
Representative Wilson and then Guttenberg.
I don't know whether anybody online can answer. So do we know why we can't go through the Department of Corrections? I mean, they already have their own system. We're talking state employees as well. I don't think they probably have a limit of how many people that they can put through there. Has that ever been researched on? Because that was when this bill came, that's the first time I had ever heard that certain agencies didn't pay any. Did anybody look at, or maybe the Department of Revenue can answer, to find out whether or not we'd be able to utilize that same system?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I have not looked at that. I know I did reach out to as many agencies as I could, and Departments of Public Safety and Corrections do it in-house because of the nature of their work. Other agencies do pay for the fingerprinting prior to employment, but I don't know if Corrections could extend that to other state employees.
Sure seems like it'd be worthwhile since this may not be the last time the federal government asks us to do something. But back to what Representative Garrett said, we may, school teachers have to do it. A lot of businesses have to do it. And so, and I am fine if I understand where Representative Kawasaki is coming from, people who are already on there, and I'm fine changing it to any future employees as well. But we just can't keep $47 doesn't seem like a lot of money, but at the same time, as we keep building things up, every little bit, makes a difference. And I know going into jobs, my kids, as they've done it, there's a lot of times that you have to do certain, whether it's background check or it's your analysis or whatever it is, depending upon what kind you have, Most of the time, it comes down to that person before they even get a job. So I made sure this wasn't just when somebody put an application in, although it might kind of slim down the applications. I wanted to make sure that they got the job first before we would require it. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm going to step back a second. For those people currently employed, and maybe Mrs. Spano or Ms. Sheehan can answer it, we're talking about state employees that have had, or maybe they haven't, but access to quite a bit of tax information that I think we rely on to be confidential to begin with. What is the difference with the background check that hopefully we're doing now with this one? Is it just the feds that say yours isn't good enough, and is ours good enough, and what's the difference? So you, when you hire somebody to do confidential tax work and business work, and, you know, we pass bills here that we're assuming this our state employees can keep a secret, and generally they, in this world, it pretty much is, but what's the difference between this requirement and what you do now?
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the background check that we do now is actually fairly current. It was in a response to that new publication by the IRS. So that publication has been around for a long time, but it was updated in 2017 with this background check and fingerprinting being part of that. And we published our we created a new policy for our background check, and we started doing that. And it's right now it's just the local background check, so it includes all the states. If you've committed a crime and you were convicted at the state level, that would show up on that background check. The national background check, it's a federal level, so if you were convicted of a federal crime, it would show up on that background check. So the fingerprinting and the federal background check is the piece that we're not doing that we need to do.
If I may.
Representative Guttenberg?
So I guess that begs the question is, if somebody commit a federal crime, in your background check currently, would you find it or wouldn't you find it?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, at the local background check, no, it wouldn't show up. We are doing, to the best of our ability, a limited federal background check. So sometimes we do get federal crimes that show up if they were convicted of those federal crimes. But to do the full, thorough background check, we need the fingerprints and to be submitted to the FBI so they can run it through their database.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of amazes me, but you know, the more we tear into this stuff, it's the more questions you ask sometimes. But I've never, in my current construction days, when I ran to UA test, you know, there was never a charge to the employees. And I know that some agencies and school districts do it, but, you know, we can't passing everything along to the employees because there are some basic things that the state needs to be doing for itself, and I think the state should be paying for it. And so I'll be opposing the amendment.
Do we have any further questions on amendment number one? Representative Seaton?
And this was for Megan Wallace.
Ms. Wallace, are you online? I don't see a Megan Wallace on here. Representative Seaton? Okay. Any other questions on amendment number one? Seeing none, is the objection on amendment number one maintained?
Yes.
The objection has been maintained. If the secretary could please call the roll.
Representative Guttenberg.
No.
Representative Kawasaki.
No.
Representative Ortiz.
Yes.
Representative Pruitt.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Tilton.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Representative Guerra.
No.
Representative Grant.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
Representative Seaton.
No.
5 yeas, 6 nays.
And so on a vote of 5 yeas to 6 nays, amendment number one, which is 30-LS1938/D.1, is failed to been adopted. So with that, do we have any further questions on the bill itself, HB 219? Seeing no further questions, Representative Guerra, would you please walk the committee through the fiscal notes?
Thank you.
Yes, Chair, there are six fiscal notes. Department of Corrections, admin support, OMB component 697, that's a zero fiscal note. OMB component 2276, that's the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Employment and Training Services. Unemployment insurance, a zero fiscal note. Department of Public Safety, statewide support, criminal justice information, OMB component 3200, that's a zero fiscal note. Department of Revenue, Taxation and Treasury, Tax Division, OMB component 2476, that's a $4,800 fiscal note for 2019, and in the out years that goes down to $500, I believe, per year. So, and then Department of Revenue, Child Support Services Division, OMB component 111. The first year, that is a fiscal note of $6,600 in federal money and $3,400 in state costs. And in the out years, that goes down to $1,000 in federal funds and $500 in state costs. And that is number 111. And then finally, OMB component number 320, Department of Health and Social Services, Department Support Services, Admin Support Services, is a zero fiscal note. The costs that I referenced were all for the background check we talked about.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. And if the Department of Revenue could please check with the Department of Corrections and find out if there is any possible way that that might be able to be done, since they're the only ones with positive fiscal notes, that would be really appreciated. Thank you.
We have any further questions on the fiscal notes? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 219. 30GH 1938/D from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? See no objections. HB 219 version 30-GH 1938/D is reported out from House Finance with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes. And so just a reminder, folks could please sign the report before we leave, and our next meeting will be scheduled. Is there anything else come for the committee? Nothing. Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chair, I did receive a note we ought to just put on that the FBI waives the fee for law enforcement agencies, and that includes corrections. So apparently the background check will include an additional fee from the FBI. If it's not for a waived agency. So I just wanted to put that.
Thank you. Okay. Our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, April 6th at 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we will hear three bills, HB 217, which is raw milk sales, food exempt from regulations, HB 219, which is extend the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and HB 231, which is a CFEC board salary staff classified service. So with that, we will be adjourned at 2:25 p.m. Thank you. And we've got the report.